I discovered a Quaker meeting. And was absolutely blown away by the fact that a group of adults would get together and sit in silence. It just had a profound effect on me. And I've always appreciated the Quakers for that, amongst other things. Eventually, I found the Buddhist path, and there hasn't been a sangha yet, or a night at a sangha, in whenever the past 45 years, where I've not had that same feeling of inspiration from and wonder that there's a group of adults of various ages and various colors and various nationalities, men and women, and gay and straight, all these different kinds of people that come together to do nothing. There's an old Quaker expression you probably know well: don't speak unless you can improve upon the silence. Which I find very inspiring, but if I was sticking to it, I would just ring the bell again and we'd sit for another 45 minutes. But I do want to ask a question related to that, and you don't have to put up your hands, but I'm doing a poll in your head as to which part of the program, whether I'm here, whether Howie's here or somebody else, which part of the program do you prefer? The sitting meditation, 45 minutes, or the Dharma talk for half an hour, 40 minutes? And just kind of ponder that for a moment. There's not really a right answer to it, but that's kind of the subject of my talk tonight, is practice, how we practice. The Buddha taught that there are three different ways of knowing anything. Different ways of learning, different ways of knowing. One, the first, is to study, to listen to a teacher, to wrap your mind around a concept, to decide whether you agree with it or not. It's kind of the way we learn in the Western world. And it was true in Buddha's time, too. There were a lot of philosophers around in Buddha's time. But the Buddha taught there was another way of learning, and that was through silent meditation, through letting go of thought and conceptual thinking, cognizing, and trusting that intuitive insights and wisdom is going to arise out of that. That was his experience. And that's what he did an awful lot of teaching about. But of course, his teaching was often the first part, the Dharma talk. And the third way of knowing is integrating the wisdom we get from the first two, from practice and from study, or realization. So practice and study are volitional activities. We decide we're going to do it, we sit down, we create time and space for meditation, and we decide we're going to do that. But insight is spontaneous. It comes to us in its own time and its own way. So that's why I asked the question about which way you prefer, which way do you prefer learning? And I know certainly for me, for many years in my practice, I preferred the first way. I preferred listening to talks, and because that's the way I was trained. That's our Western way of doing it. And we like to kind of complicate things. You know, somebody gets out a concept and we'll chew on it and we'll turn it over and we'll argue about it and we'll take a position and have views and opinions. But the meditation practice part can be a lot more simple than that. And I think as Westerners, sometimes we don't trust it. We don't trust that as a way of learning because of the simplicity of it. So I want to talk a little bit about practice and what happens in meditation. And I was really inspired to this topic by a poem that I found in a chiropractor's office a couple of weeks ago. I was sitting in the waiting room and I cracked open this magazine, The Sun. I don't know if you know that magazine. And I didn't even flip through it. I opened it up to this page and there was this poem that just jumped out at me. And it's by Michael Bazette, and it's called Nobody Fails in Meditation. Nobody fails at meditation like I do. They say, note the arrival of thoughts and allow them to pass through like clouds crossing a summer sky. Let judgment go. But one cloud is always running, like a woman in a torn dress, the wind pressing its folds against her body, and I suddenly wish to wheel around on my horse and thunder back to the farmhouse, splattering her white frock with mud as I swing from the saddle into her trembling arms. That is a perfect description of what we call papancha in the Pali language. Papancha is discursive thought. It's where an image or an idea comes to us out of nowhere. Oh, that cloud is like a woman in a torn dress. And all of a sudden, my feet are in the stirrups and I'm riding a horse and off we go. It's what happens so often in meditation is we don't even know how we end up on that horse. We're just, you know, riding off into the sunset. And then we sometimes hopefully notice it and we come back and to our breath and start all over again, and then it's something else. But I love the fact that papancha, discursive thought, what we do with a simple thought that just bubbles up. I like to say there's a difference between a thought and thinking. Thoughts just bubble up. It's what the mind produces them. They're based on conditions, the way we're raised. Thinking is what we do with them. We look for meaning for meanings in things. What's the meaning of that? What's the meaning of life? Those questions the Buddha refused to answer more often than not. The Buddha did not deal with, did not entertain metaphysical questions. He said, "I teach only suffering and the end of suffering." The Buddha talked about not what things mean, but how they work. He was a pragmatist. How things actually work. So meditation moves us in the opposite direction of papancha. Papancha is what we do pretty much in our everyday life when we're not being mindful and we're not paying too much attention. Our mind just goes here and there and gets on a horse or a train or a stagecoach and goes its own way. But in meditation, we try to simplify our experience and we try to catch ourselves before we make that cognitive leap. Mindfulness is a precognitive experience. And we very often take whatever happens with mindfulness and turn it into a cognitive experience. So trying to notice when that happens in our meditation and even in everyday life is a really interesting practice. Because meditation practice, and it's not the easiest thing to do. It's a fairly easy thing to teach, and we all know it's not the easiest thing to do sometimes. Uncovers our natural, simple mind. Devoid of self, devoid of opinions, devoid of all those things that we're so fond of adding to our experience. So meditation is a lot about uncovering and taking away from and renunciation, erasing what's piled on top of our basic direct experience. Whereas cognitive activities, we tend to add to our experience. In meditation, we try to get back to the roots of basic consciousness. And consciousness only comes to us, and the information of consciousness comes to us through our five senses. Plus, the Buddha added a sense, and that was mind. That very often throws Westerners for a loop. But we have five sense organs: eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body, and the mental organ. So the Buddha taught that that's basically the source of all our information. Everything else is add-on. Everything else is added on by cognitive ability. And so if we can get back to the direct experience of our senses, of our five senses, we create some spaciousness and the opportunity for insight. And the Buddha added mind to that sense, and the sense that the mind produces thoughts. They're conditioned, they're based on how we were raised and information we've taken in and what we saw yesterday and what we had for breakfast this morning, but they're just thoughts that bubble up. And in that sense, they're no more important and no more weighty than the random sounds we hear coming from outside, which are just sounds. Of course, we don't spend a sixth of our time on each one of these senses. They're not equally divided, if you think about it. We probably spend 95% of our time in the mind organ, in the brain. So meditation is an opportunity to pay attention to all of our senses and the information that they provide. There was a mathematician in the early 20th century named G.H. Hardy who has this wonderful quote: "A beautiful mathematical proof should be as slender as one of Shelley's odes, and like an ode, it should imply vastness." A beautiful mathematical proof should be as slender as one of Shelley's odes, and like an ode, it should imply vastness. And I find that a lot of the Buddha's teachings do just that, in the same sort of the way. The Buddha taught for 40 years, more than 40 years. The collected translations of the Buddha's sutta is the Pali way of saying it. Sutta is just a teaching. Fill up a couple of large bookshelves. And that's just what's been translated in English. Believe it or not, some of the Buddha suttas have not been translated yet. They're still working on that. So unlike many other great religious teachers of history, the Buddha gave us a lot of information, gave us 40 years of teachings that were passed down. And that's been the basis for enormously big universities, originally in India and then Sri Lanka and Thailand, and the foundation of different Buddhist traditions and a lot of scholarly tradition, because even Buddhists like to add information to basic experience, despite the fact that the Buddha was saying, just pay attention to your direct experience. Scholars take that and run with it. So there's a particular sutta of the Buddha's that I'm really fond of because it goes to this point. It's the Bahia story. Some of you might know it. Bahia was this teacher in the Buddha's time, a contemporary of the Buddha's. And he lived in a different part of India, and he had been teaching for many years, and it's not specific. We don't know exactly what he taught or what his beliefs were, his theories were, but he probably meditated and probably did yoga like the Buddha did. But we know that he had followers. It's in the sutta. We know that he had followers and was well respected. And Bahia, at the time, they had devas and devatas, who were kind of spirits, friendly spirits, sometimes not friendly spirits. But you could make offerings to devas and devatas, and you could have conversations with them. And that became more of a lasting tradition in the Hindu tradition than in the Buddhist tradition. But in Buddhist time, people would talk about their relationships with devas and devatas. And Bahia had a conversation with his guardian devata, a female friendly spirit who was kind of watching over him. And he asked her, he said, "You know, I seem to be doing okay here. What do you say? Am I an arhat? Am I enlightened?" And the devata said, "Well, sorry, Bahia, but no, you're not yet." And Bahia said, "Well, what am I missing? Is there someone that can give me the missing pieces or teach me what I need to learn in order to be awakened? And the devata said, well, yeah, there's this Buddha guy who's teaching, and he is enlightened, and he has a great many followers, but he clearly is a wise man, and you would benefit from consulting with him. So Bahia made a great journey to find the Buddha. And after some time, he did find the Buddha, and there's kind of an amusing passage in the sutta about Bahia asking the Buddha, finally finding the Buddha, and the Buddha is just getting ready to set out on alms rounds, which is their only meal of the day, and the monks, as they do today, take their begging bowls out into the villages, and whatever is offered, just like our dana system, whatever is offered is what they have for food and robes and shelter. And this only happens for a couple of hours before noon in the day, so it's kind of an important activity. This is the eating part of the day. So Bahia found the Buddha just as the Buddha was, and the monks were heading out on alms rounds to collect dana. And Bahia introduced himself and said, Buddha, will you teach me? Will you tell me what I need to know? And the Buddha said, well, no, we're going on alms rounds. And Bahia asked him again. After he was kind of ignored for a while, and he said, I've come a very long way. Will you teach me? And the Buddha didn't say exactly what he said, but essentially Buddha's saying it's lunch. And so Bahia had to ask a third time. And this is a pattern in a lot of the suttas. And I'm not quite sure what it means, but there seemed to have been a belief, and it shows up a number of times in the suttas, that if you ask the Buddha something three times, he has to answer. So Bahia was really insistent and asked three times. And on the third time, on his third ask, this is what the Buddha said to this very learned man. And the Buddha knew he was a learned man. He'd achieved some practice. Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized. Then, Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress. Stress is one of the translations for dukkha. This is the end of dukkha. So that's just a profoundly simple and direct teaching where the Buddha is telling this very learned man, just pay attention to your senses, the seen, the heard, the felt, the sensed, the cognized. Cognized are thoughts that arise that we don't attach to. Simply meditate. Pay attention to what comes to your senses. Let everything else go. Don't interpret. Don't speculate about what it means. Just pay attention to the senses. Simplify your practice. This is the way I interpret this teaching, as Buddha's saying to this very learned man, you're thinking too much. Simplify your practice. Just use your senses. Bahia became enlightened as a result of this teaching a short time afterwards. Buddha had tended to have that effect on him. Buddha had that impact on a lot of people. There's many stories in the suttas of people hearing Buddha will give a particular teaching about something, and then they'll say, and so-and-so became enlightened. Bahia became enlightened. So it's what he needed to hear. And he fulfilled the purpose of his trip. There's a little sidebar to this story, and this is in the sutta. Bahia got gored by a cow and killed very shortly after he met the Buddha, and before he had a chance to get home. And the sutta doesn't really make any commentary on this, except that the Buddha arranged his funeral and said Bahia is to be honored, and Bahia is one of the enlightened ones, and he's one of us, and he arranged the monks to take care of Bahia's funeral. But otherwise, there's not a lot of commentary on this, but my interpretation of that, is the way I read it, is do your practice. You never know what's going to happen. You know, Bahia got hit by the proverbial truck. So the thing I love about that teaching is the pragmatism and the simplicity of it. We don't need to be great scholars. We don't even need to be literate to understand that teaching or to do the practice. The practice is so simple and so direct, and that's something in my own practice that I've been noticing lately, because at various times over the years, I've become quite enamored with book learning and study and parsing out the meanings and comparing things and the teachings. And it's taken me a while to realize that the practice is a good deal simpler than that. But I think as Westerners, it's hard for us to trust that. I don't know if that's true for some of you, but it's hard for us to trust that simply being quiet, simply cultivating stillness and silence and spaciousness is the root of wisdom. But that's the radical teaching of the Buddha. That's something that really sets the Buddha apart from other great teachers of all of history, not to mention the teachers of his time. The Buddha lived at a pretty incredible time. Karen Armstrong, the theologian and author, wrote a book about the Axial Age, and it was the Buddha's age. And at this time, Lao Tzu was alive, Confucius, the pre-Socratic Greek philosophers, a lot of the great origins of both Eastern and Western philosophy were happening right exactly the time that the Buddha lived. So it's a really interesting phenomenon. And in India was one of the great, there were many empires and many kingdoms, but one of the great centers of learning. So it's really interesting to view the Buddha and the Buddha's teaching in light of the kind of thought and debate and philosophy that was happening at his time. Because there's aspects of it that are truly radical and truly different. And obviously true, because we've been practicing it for more than 2,500 years. There's been a lot of practical experimentation into what some people might call the Buddha's theory, but it's not a theory at all. It's the Buddha's practice. Buddha said, check it out for yourself. Don't listen to the teachers, including this one. I know how he's pointed it out, but to get back to that, which part of the program do you like, the meditation part or the Dharma talk part? In the Zen tradition, there's an expression that the teacher is simply pointing his finger at the moon, or her finger at the moon. But in meditation practice, you're experiencing the moon itself, and the moon is a metaphor for enlightenment in the Zen tradition. And when you meditate, you're experiencing the moon directly. You're having your own direct experience of the reality of the present moment. And it might not seem like a profound thing, and it might not seem like awakening. But whenever our self falls away, our sense of self falls away, and our judgments and our comparisons and our cognating mind, and we're left in that a beautiful place of stillness and silence, that's an awakening moment. And I imagine some of you had one tonight, and you might not have recognized it. So I read the poem, Nobody Fails at Meditation, and that's such a great example of papancha and the mind kind of running amok. And I have to balance that off with the opposite. And this is a poem called Awareness Knowing Itself by Dana Folds. Settle in the here and now. Reach down into the center where the world is not spinning and drink this holy place. Feel relief flood into every cell. Nothing to do. Nothing to be but what you are already. Nothing to receive but what flows effortlessly from the mystery into form. Nothing to run from or run toward, just this breath. Awareness, knowing itself as embodiment. Just this breath. Awareness, waking up to truth. I don't know what to say about that. So that's my offering. I wanted to talk about practice tonight and what seems like hard practice and what seems like simple practice. And I wanted to talk about papancha and what our minds do. And that's not necessarily bad practice. If we're noticing that papancha is happening, that's good practice. And if we notice stillness and silence, that's good practice too, as long as we're noticing. But I hope we put as much value, at least, on the meditation part of learning in this tradition, even when it seems hard, even when it's difficult, as we do on what we read in books and what we hear from teachers. And I just want to put a plug in for things that Howie doesn't talk about very often, because he's Howie, but I can, because I'm a student. And that's the benefit of doing a retreat. If you've never done a retreat, put it on your agenda next year or the year after that. If you really want to give a sudden boost to your practice, to your meditation practice, that's truly the easiest way of doing it. I recommend retreats. And I know it's hard to find the time. But we try to create other avenues for supporting your practice here at Mission Dhamma. And one is the class that we've been doing for the past year, and we're going to keep trying to do that so that everybody that wants to, that's interested, has a chance. And that class is really about practice. It's not about Buddhist theory. It's really about supporting your practice and developing a meditation practice and different things you could do with meditation. There's different objects of meditation and different types of meditation. Loving kindness, for example. Any one of them can be a path to awakening. So we try to show you some of that. So that's another thing we try to do at Mission Dhamma. And a third thing is I don't know if everyone's aware of it, but Howie's available for interviews. He's available to talk to you about your practice. That's something that he does. It needs to be scheduled. But Howie has office hours. So one of the things I've learned in the past few years, I practiced for years without ever talking to anybody about what I was doing in my meditation practice. And for many years, I'd show up at Sangha and I would sit and I'd listen to a Dharma talk and I'd go home and I never met anybody. So we've been trying to create opportunities for people to meet each other in the Sangha, and also to get support through the class and through meeting with Howie, and just supporting each other. The Buddha said that along with Dharma and Buddha, that Sangha was the third leg of the structure that all of the Dharma is based on. Sangha is terribly important. And that sense that I was talking about, that I got from Quaker meetings and I get from sitting here with you, there's a powerful supportive energy that happens just sitting together, even if we don't know each other, if we haven't met each other. But it can also be pretty amazing when we start talking to each other and making some Dharma friends and sharing our practice. So I want to encourage all of that in whatever way might support you. So I hope you take advantage, and I hope to meet all of you sometime. I mean, truly, I'd like to meet all of you at one point or another. So come up and introduce yourself. I'll be back to Sangha. I'm not here every week, but I'm around. And there's other wonderful teachers and dedicated practitioners and volunteers. Oh, you know, another great way to support your practice of the Sangha is to volunteer and make friends. And there's lots of opportunities for that I won't go into it. We'll talk about that another time. So thank you for your kind attention, and thank you for your practice. Whatever your practice is, I know at least you're showing up on Tuesday nights and practicing here. I hope you're giving it a shot at home as well. But thank you for your practice, because it supports me, and it supports all of your fellow yogis here. It's a beautiful and moving thing. So let's just be quiet for a moment, and then I'll offer some merit. It's a beautiful thing to remember, remind ourselves that our practice isn't just about us. That we support each other, and that the merit of our practice, the impact of our practice, is carried out of this church with us, into our daily lives. It has an impact on our loved ones, the people we come into contact with during the day. People we don't even speak to, homeless people. So may the merit of our practice benefit all beings. And at this particularly difficult time in world history, when there are so many areas of conflict and war and hunger and danger, may we particularly send out wishes for well-being to those people that are suffering. May all beings be safe and protected from danger and harm. May all beings be healthy in body and mind. May all beings have the opportunity to live with peace and ease. May all beings be free from suffering. Thank you, and Howie will be back in this seat next week.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org. www.lifeonearth.org/donate.